Welcome to the DJE Podcast, where you will learn about real estate investing from real life examples. Here's your host, Devin Elder.
Okay, welcome to the show. As always, if you have multifamily questions and you would like to schedule a quick call with myself or my team, you can go to djetexas.com and do that. Today on the show, we have Mr. Jeremy Roll. Very excited to dive into this, but a quick bio here before we get started. Jeremy started investing in real estate and businesses in 2002 and left the corporate world in 2007 to become a full-time passive cash flow investor. He is currently an investor in more than 70 opportunities across more than $1 billion worth of real estate and business assets. As founder and president of Roll Investment Group, Jeremy manages a group of over 1,000 investors who seek passive slash managed cash flowing investments in real estate and businesses. He's also the co-founder of For Investors by Investors, FIBI, a nonprofit organization that was launched in 2007 with the goal of facilitating networking and learning among real estate investors in a strict no sales pitch environment. FIBI is now the largest group of public real estate investor meetings in California with over 30,000 members. Jeremy has an MBA from the Wharton School, is a licensed California real estate broker for investing purposes only, and is an advisor for Realty Mogul, the largest real estate crowdfunding website in the U.S. Jeremy welcomes emails jroll@rollinvestments.com to network or help other investors and to discuss real estate or business investments of any size. Okay, so without further ado, Mr. Jeremy Roll, how are you? Jeremy, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate you having me here.
Yeah. So I saw you speak in Dallas at an event, and I really enjoyed your presentation. And, you know, the takeaway I got was that, I would think of you as kind of a super passive investor, right? In lots of passive investments, lots of different geographies, et cetera. And so I think that's a very valuable perspective for our audience. What initially brought you to real estate as a passive investment?
Sure. So my story, which goes back a while now, so I've been investing passively in real estate for about 18 years. We're recording this now at the end of 2019, and I started back in the beginning of 2002. And that was really the result of the dot-com crash for me. Once the dot-com crash happened and I was working in the corporate world, two things bothered me from the dot-com crash that, you know, one is probably more obvious than the other. One is that there was a lot of volatility. So, you know, it wasn't for me to watch like my portfolio go up and down 30% in a year, but more importantly, the lack of predictability of where my retirement account was all going in the next 10, 20, 30 years really bothered me. So when I started to look at different ways to invest for predictability and came across the concept of being passive, because I was actually very busy. I was actually working at Disney headquarters in Burbank, California at the time. Really busy job. Couldn't do anything actively in terms of time. And so I looked at passive. And then I concluded that if I can find kind of lower risk, more diversified tenant base, which helps also reduce risk, passive cash flow opportunities, that would be the way for me to go to get more predictability. So I really started for predictability, and I started on the path back then. I've just been continuing on the path since. And, you know, the best way to describe just trying to build my big, cash flow snowball, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's great. What was there a certain group or book that you read that was kind of instrumental in making that transition?
So I hate to say it. So the good news is I went to a lot of networking meetings to learn. I actually was at the time was not married, had no kids, and I was in the big city, Los Angeles. So I had the ability to find a lot of meetings on especially meetup.com, and went to probably an average of maybe two meetings a week and really dedicated to learning. The bad news is that I am, it's going to sound bad, but I am not a book reader. Like, I couldn't tell you the last time I read an entire book. I listened to them. I'll watch YouTube videos. I'll go to a meeting for 2 hours, but reading an entire book has always been a challenge for me, even all back to like when I was in school way back. So, I had not read any books in advance. What's interesting is that after the fact, I had read Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki and Cashflow Quadrant by Robert Kiyosaki, two that I strongly recommend, and actually to read both of them in that order. And then I realized that I kind of went through a bit of that transition in certain ways and up investing the way that he recommends investing in it, kind of with a similar philosophy, but it was like after the fact and not beforehand in terms of learning. So I don't have a very good answer for you for that.
No, I appreciate the transparency. And I think that certainly, you know, the Kiyosaki book is a foundation for a lot of investors, myself included.
Yeah. I want to say one thing though, sorry. I just want to say one thing. The irony of all this is that I actually read about 2 to 3 hours a day of news.
Right.
And that's for me to stay on top of the trends, to stay on top of what's going on, to try to read between the lines in the media and get out of the weeds and look at the data. So I actually do a ton of reading, but just sitting down to a full book, that's a hard thing for me. Anyway, sorry.
Yep. No, understood. And Audible's fantastic. I've got probably hundreds of titles on there and another hundreds of hours of podcasts to consume, and it's good stuff. What kind of data are you consuming for news sources? I mean, you're looking at demographic changes, you're looking at migration, you're in a lot of different markets. So what's of interest to you there?
All of the above. So I invest across almost all the major asset classes in both commercial and residential real estate, as well as some other things like ATM machines, a little bit of oil and gas, even some startups. Those are very rare for me. But the point is that I got to try and stay on top of all the major trends. And the best way to describe it is that I'm trying to understand two different things. One is what's going on with the economy today and in the next 12 to 24 months. And that to me is a combination of mainstream media, because I think that can actually affect consumer sentiment depending on what's being published. So I do stay on top of it that way, along with reading between the lines on some of the actual data that's being released, not in the mainstream media, but the actually what's going on the underlying of what's going on, in combination with like a 5 to 10 year view. So when I invest passively, I trade controlled for diversification. That's what I like to tell people. And also I get to do less work, and at least less work ongoing, not up front. And but what I have to do is think in far in advance, because I normally get into a 5 or 10 year deal. And that's kind of the timeline, projected timeline, could be go further. And so that means that I've got to think 10 years ahead and try to come up with a thesis of where the most predictability is for someone like me and where the landmines might be. So really easy examples, you know, Blockbuster, right? If you invested in a mall that had the major anchor tenants of Blockbuster 15 years ago and you were in a 10-year deal, where would you be 5 years ago? Not in a good place, necessarily.
Right.
So, you know, it's that staying on top of those trends and try to, I would say, as opposed to predict, just avoid the landmines, help reduce risk and stay away from what could happen or has a higher probability of happening. So I kind of look at the news in those two different buckets, so to speak, the short term, so to speak, and then the longer term.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. It's an interesting comment about the mainstream media being, whether it's true, false, whatever it is, biased, not biased, doesn't matter. It can still impact sentiment, right? Which is going to move markets.
Exactly. And so, you know, I would say that mainstream, I'm not a conspiracy theorist necessarily,
sure.
But look, people own these different outlets. They can have probably some selection over what's published on them. I don't think it's a coincidence sometimes when you start reading about articles about the recession across multiple, different channels at once, that could be purposeful, not purposeful. The more important point to your point is that it will affect consumer sentiment. So, and to me, you know, consumers represent about 70% of consumer spending represents about 70% of GDP. And, you know, so if we're potentially going to have a downturn, it could very well be from consumer spending. So I pay a lot of attention to consumer sentiment and what could potentially change that as well.
Yeah. Yep. Very interesting. What was the first passive investment in real, you know, we talk about real estate on the show. So while I'm personally very interested about, you know, hearing a startup story or oil and gas story, maybe we can take that offline. But in terms of the real estate kind of passive syndicated model, what did that first investment look like for you? Was it an existing relationship, or did you have to go out and seek and vet a bunch of sponsors?
Yeah, I got lucky. So it was a little unusual. I had lifelong friends in my family. And so I'm from Montreal and I grew up there, and I've known these people since I was like 5 years old, 6 years old, roughly. And they had been syndicating already for a decade or two. The father had been doing that. I was very good friends with the son. And long story short is that I kind of knew them well enough to know that I could probably learn from them, and that I would probably a good starting point to trust them in terms of investing with them. So that's where I started. I actually started, even though I was in LA, I started investing in Canada, where I'm from, and I started investing with them specifically to learn. So I was very lucky because I had a built-in tool to learn from the opportunity I was investing in it to probably a much, much more detailed degree than an average investor. So that's how I started. I've since invested in over 20 deals with that particular syndicator. The funny thing is, someone asked me yesterday what the first deal was, and I'd have to literally go back. I can't remember because I've been in so many deals. It was either office or retail deal, because that's what they do.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's great. I mean, the trust component and the track record, all that stuff's really important. And especially if you got a lifelong family, friends type situation, that's a huge advantage. Was there a moment after getting into that first investment specifically to learn that you decided that you were really going to go all in on this? Or was this kind of a progression for you deal by deal and kind of exploring your way through it that way?
It was a progression. I'm a really low risk guy. Anybody knows me knows that. And so this was like a dipping my toe in the water. And it wasn't just that I was learning from them, to be clear. I went out hardcore. I'm going to a lot of meetings in LA. And so this was a combination of learning from them and learning in general. And what's really great is that I also had the fortune that a lot of the local meetings we have here are either single family or multifamily related. And that's because they're very popular asset classes and a lot of people can relate to them and understand them. I happened to be learning about office and retail from them. I was going to meetings learning about single family, multifamily, maybe the odd other thing as well. So it was really good to have both of those coming in at the same time. But I am also very cautious. So I was going to have to get quite detailed in the learning before I was going to dip my toe with, let's say, a whole bunch of random deals. I'm not that guy that would have just jumped into, if I didn't really understand something really thoroughly, just like trying five different things in the first 6 months, just not my personality. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just not my personality.
Yep. No, that's great. So you had a lot of networking opportunities early on. And fortunately, you're in a very, you know, dense metro there, a lot of opportunity. What would you say to somebody that's kind of starting out in this game, maybe as a passive investor, as far as networking, where there's some efficiencies you developed over time or things that you kind of learned doing so much networking? Because sometimes it can be time consuming and energy consuming, and you're not sure which events are going to yield fruit, etc. Any thoughts on that process?
Yeah, great question. So I do have a couple tips. And the first thing I'll say is anyone who's starting listening to this, you know, thanks to technology and the evolution of a lot of different things, it's actually a lot easier for you to start today than when I started. And I'll give you some examples. But let me directly answer your question a little better first. So first thing I'll say is if you're trying to find meetings, meetup.com for me has been a fantastic source. It's pretty well known. Some of you may have heard of it. I would strongly recommend looking at it. Next thing you want to do is take a look at how many people have registered to attend a meeting. I am of the philosophy that, you know, I prefer to go to a place for my time that has more people, a bigger critical mass. And so I would start with the bigger critical mass. I would try your best to read the description and see if you think it might be a sales pitch or not, because I am extremely averse to sales pitches. And so I try to stay away from those. And one of the great things about going to a larger meeting or two first is that you'll find a lot of other investors there. And some people have been going to a lot of meetings, and take advantage of asking them which meetings to go to and which meetings to avoid in your area. That is one great way to accelerate and to make it a little more efficient for you going forward. So that's one recommendation for sure. There's a lot you can accomplish online these days, though, honestly. Right. And that's what I was referring to before. Like when I wanted to learn, I did it all through what I call opportunity exposure. And that means that I was trying to find opportunities out there, and I have to go network to find all of them. None of them were allowed to be publicly marketed at the time. And I had to go find them and then, you know, network to find each single one. That's very inefficient. Whereas if you're an accredited investor today, as an example, you can log on to the top 5 or 10 crowdfunding websites, real estate sites, and in your pajamas in an hour, download 10 multifamily opportunities of a certain type, even, and hone in and actually compare them all and learn from them all very quickly. Literally would have taken me, I'm not exaggerating, months to accomplish that, to find that many deals in the networkings, and maybe longer even. So, you know, it's a great time to actually potentially start to learn, because there's a lot more efficiency that you can achieve. There's also, how many of you have heard of Bigger Pockets? You know, Bigger Pockets is a great resource in that there's hundreds of thousands of users on it now in the US. It's probably the biggest single community for real estate online that I'm aware of. And it also could be a great place to learn or where to get recommendations to learn in terms of efficiency. You got to be careful though. There are people on Bigger Pockets who might be trying to sell things. And so you've got to kind of wad through those, but overall it can be a fantastic resource. It's really good for efficiency. And one more thing I'd recommend for efficiency, which didn't exist when I was starting, was there are some conferences now across the US that specialize either in an asset class like multifamily, where you and I think originally met, even across multiple asset classes. And that's definitely time and money that you have to spend. But if you don't have the ability to go to like a couple of meetings a month, or even a couple of meetings in a couple of months, you may want to just go all in on a larger conference that may have 300, 400, 500, 600 people. And in 2-3 days, you can get a lot of efficiency out of that if you're willing to trade the time for that and the money. So those are some suggestions I have. We can go a lot more into this because, as you mentioned in my bio, I have co-founded what ended up being a pretty large series of meetings. And so I'm very familiar with networking and meetings. So
that's great. That's great feedback. I like the point you made about you go to a meetup event, then you find the guy that's more experienced and say, hey, let me leverage your pain and suffering over the last 3 years of weeding out the good meetings from the bad. And let me just copy paste, you know, your recommendation there. I really like that. I also like, I like conferences. I don't like flying and being away from my family and staying in a hotel. Unless it's a really cool city, then it's maybe a little different. Or, you know, my wife and I have one coming up in New Orleans where we're going to take an extra day, and that's, but I do like, the cover charge aspect kind of weeds out a lot of people that you might, I don't mean people, but a certain kind of tier or interest level or seriousness that of type of folks that you're going to get at a meetup, where you're just going to kind of get all, everybody out there. Whereas somebody pays a couple $100 to go to a conference, get a hotel and airfare, you're looking at $1,000 investment minimum, maybe more. And so you got a room of several hundred people of at least that level of seriousness, right?
Yes, 100% agree. And in fact, I would also put out a word of caution that this is probably not a perfectly correlated statement, but I have found over the years that the conferences that's or meetings or let's say seminars or whatever that are between $300 and $900 are typically the core, like the ones where there's probably not much of a sales pitch and also weeding people out you're talking about. Stuff that's over $1,000 or $2,000 especially, you're going to want to watch out for like what kind of, you know, are they trying to like just sell you books and tapes? What's going on? That's kind of the irony, right? That could be actually the not as productive conference for you to go to. Stuff that's free, same problem. Then they're just trying to get you to the door to upsell you to actually break even or make money off the venue. So I do feel like, to your point, if you can get in that mid-range, and again, there might be good meetings that are more expensive, but just if you're starting, I would tell you to be extra careful with those as far as, you know, your time and money.
Yeah, that's a great point. You've got kind of that Goldilocks mid-spot on a conference range. I've experienced the same thing, but I've never really put it in that context. That's an interesting takeaway.
Yeah, it's definitely like, you know, it's a broad statement, but I think it holds true a lot of the time.
Right. No, that's great. It's a good rule of thumb. So you've got a variety of passive investments, different asset classes. What do you enjoy doing today? Do you enjoy spending a lot of time reviewing existing investments, you know, vetting future investments, or do you, you know, are you retired? Are you spending a lot of time playing golf? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, no, I am the opposite of retired and I just don't have it in me anyway, but I am on the phone all day long. In fact, if you were to click on my scheduling today, I'm booked for like a month and a half. And granted, it's like the holidays. I've taken a few weeks out of it with my family, but still. So I'm usually about fully booked about 2 to 3 weeks in advance. It's a ton of networking that I do. So networking is what allows me to find opportunities. That's a key component for me. So right. I'm spending my days talking to either other investors to network. I do actually get on the phone, honestly, with a lot of new investors to help them. And I talk to operators talking about deals that they have. And I talk to investor groups. I have my own group. Sometimes I co-invest with other groups, et cetera. But I also like talking to them to share what they're up to, just learn about what they think about what's going on in the market. So I am on the phone all day long networking. And I've built up a very large network over 18 years. So as the snowball grows, you get busier and busier. So I am definitely, you know, you may be thinking, okay, he's got all these cash flow streams. Yes, if I take tomorrow off, everything's fine. But not only do I not have the personality, that's just not the way this works. Because if you don't keep reinvesting and reinvesting your money is not only going to lose out to inflation, but your snowball is going to get smaller. And ultimately, right, my goal is to build a bigger and bigger and bigger cash flow snowball. So I am extremely busy. But I love what I do. I love looking at new deals. And
that's the part I was waiting for. Cause I love busyness. Yeah. If you're doing what you, if you love it, right?
Yes. Now I will say that it's been very frustrating for me since early 2017. And I went through this between 2005 and 2008, because I've been mostly on the sidelines kind of waiting for maybe a market adjustment, and stuff. And so I've been, you know, involved in a lot of sales, over 25 sales in the last two and a half to 3 years, but not be able to redeploy all that money. My cash flow is coming down a little bit because I can't, you know, keep that snowball growing because of the fact there's not a lot out there that I'm comfortable investing in. And sure. So, and I know that's very subjective, obviously. So looking at deals these days is not as fun as it would be in a different part of the cycle for me. But overall, I love looking at new deals.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's an interesting comment about the market cycle, right? We're in this weird kind of Frankenstein economy where you've got a really long expansion. You've got unprecedented amounts of quantitative easing that are distorting everything, really. What are your thoughts on, I guess I'm glad that the US dollar is dominant and hopefully is for the foreseeable future. Printing all this money as an owner and, an owner of large assets, you're seeing some inflation, you're seeing asset price inflation, that part, it's good. But what are your thoughts on kind of this, the last decade of quantitative easing? What's that doing to asset prices?
Yeah.
And to the market in general.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's very artificial, but that's the reality of what we're in. And so I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. I think it's just going to increase. I think they have no choice. If I've been saying this for 10 years already, if you go back to Japan in the early 90s and see what's happened with them since in their debt to GDP, because they're kind of the number one debt to GDP, and the fact that they've been able to stumble along. So what's happened is that they kind of started in this place back then and had a growth problem because of their demographics and some other issues too. And so long story short is that their long-term, what's called not base growth, I forget the term, but their ability for their economy to perform is reasonably in the 1% range right now. And 1 to 2%, whatever it is, and sometimes lower. And that's because of the debt overhang. We're getting towards that, right? If you look at the average annualized GDP growth in the past decade after the last downturn, it's been lower, and it's because of the debt overhang. And I think that's going to get worse and worse. So we're going to kind of go from an economic growth perspective, very sideways for a long time, in my opinion anyway. I think that's going to cause interest rates to remain low. I think they're going to have no choice but to keep them low to actually have more QE, print more money. At the same time, though, I'm a firm believer that this can go on for a long time because Japan has proven it. What I am really looking at actually in the next decade, talking about the 2020s up to 2030, is we're at a point where a lot of things have been kicked down the road. The can's been kicked down a lot of different ways, and that's what the QE is as well. But there are some social programs coming up where the kicking has to eventually stop, just in terms of when they're projected to be defunct, et cetera. So I think that by the end of the 2020s, there will be pretty significant changes either discussed and or implemented in some of these programs. I think some pensions are going to have very significant problems because if we go sideways and our growth does not increase and interest rates go down, not only are they not going to be making the returns they need to make, they're going to be even lower. And those are going to be far below their, projected returns that they had, to substantiate that they're, they'll be less insolvent than they already are, because most of them are insolvent, right? And so, and most is probably not a fair word, but many of them are insolvent. And so I think there's going to be a lot of problems coming up that we're going to have to deal with, and it'll be interesting to see how they're dealt with. But I think, honestly, they're going to have to deal with them by printing money, bailing out, et cetera. I don't see many other ways. And I think it's just going to continue on. When all this happens, to your point, asset prices tend to increase. The disparity between, the rich and the poor unfortunately grows. And I think we're going to have more and more challenges that way. I think taxes go up to be able to make up for some of this. And so anyway, long story short, though, I do agree with you. I think that we're going to see more and more QE and other types of methods that are similar. And I think we're going to go sideways for a long time from an economic perspective.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the perspective. It's, this is such a macroeconomic animal. I'm worried about my 120 unit down the street, right? But it does, there's correlations there. So I really appreciate your perspective. What do you look for when you're evaluating markets? Do you have a set, I'm in these 15 markets, or are you looking at new markets? And if so, what markers are you looking for there?
Sure. So, just to be clear, there's 1,000 ways to invest. None of them are necessarily wrong or right. This is what I personally do. And so just to kind of funnel down some of the initial thoughts. So I am open to any market in the US that is either not a volatile or hot market. Okay. More stable market for predictability for myself. What I've concluded for myself is that means I typically target what I call like a a B market. And what I mean by that is I'm not in Los Angeles because of the volatility of pricing, not in San Francisco for the same reason. I'm also not in Denver, and I'm not in Seattle, for example, because those markets have been really hot. And that means that they have a higher probability of potentially adjusting down. And that's the volatility I try to stay away from, right? So I look at B markets, not C markets, but B markets. I look outside of California because the cap rates and the cash flow is better outside of California for the same reason I just mentioned. And now I invest across all different asset classes. So some markets make more sense than others for some asset classes. Some of them are weather related. Some of them are demographic related. I can give you all different examples across all different asset classes. So the answer is it will depend on the asset class. But I start off by honing in on a class B asset in a B market, and I'm open to any market that quote unquote couldn't make sense, because I don't want to pretend like I know all the markets in the US. I clearly don't. So right. I'm open-minded to it, but I'm open-minded to within that funnel that I just mentioned.
That's great. That's a great overview. Is there a lens or filter that you put on that with regard to, you know, the landlord friendliness of the market, you know, in Oregon versus Texas, right? Being pretty different in that regard.
Yeah. So the thing that's been on my radar recently is and I'm concerned this is going to get worse and worse or worse. I think it's going to become more prevalent, which is, I'm completely blanking on the name.
What rent is the control term? In New York City.
Rent control. Thank you. Rent control. Completely blanked out. I'm sorry. So I think that rent control has become more and more prevalent. And we've seen some of it locally where I am here in LA and California recently. And I think that it's becoming more and more prevalent. I think that's the result of the continued disparity between the rich and the poor and, you know, some of the political, measures that will be taken to help that. So I think that that is a bit of a concern. Although it's funny, in the way that I invest, I look for stability. I'm not looking for markets to grow a ton. I do a little bit of value out at the beginning of the cycle, not normally at the end of a cycle, but regardless, I don't normally depend on huge growth. So even those rent control limits won't affect the way I invest as much as maybe the next person in some cases. But that is definitely something that's on my radar. Certainly the demographic shifts that are occurring right now and where the population is projected to go in the next 10 years, that's always very important to me, trying to avoid the landmines. So if you look at like Texas and Florida being number one and two states for projected population growth, I find that very interesting. But then even within those states, I'll focus on certain asset classes. You know, like I'll give you an example. I can give you so many examples, but in Florida, I'm very happy to invest in a self-storage facility. There's few, if no windows, there's very little damage. Insurance is usually required by the tenants in case there is damage from hurricane for flooding. Any CapEx that may result from that damage is typically less significant than a building that had 1,000 windows in it. Right. So, right. And it's also low lying. So, I'm more apt to invest in that than potentially either a mobile home park. And by the way, I would consider it, but I'm just trying to make an easy example, or a building that has 2,000 windows or whatever it is. Right. So, it's going to depend on the area, and some, even like the, cost of housing, rental versus ownership and everything can affect depending on what type of housing makes sense in what area. Mobile home parks, another example where like I love investing in the Midwest, but sometimes in the South it's tough because the average price of a home is so low and the average price of an apartment is so low that the spread isn't necessarily there to make mobile home parks quite as attractive. The demand isn't quite as high. So I'm just making a generalization, but hopefully this is making sense to some of your listeners. So it really depends on the asset class, you know, in terms of us really nailing it down.
Yep. That's great. That's great feedback. So the market is certainly a consideration. The asset class is a consideration. Where is the weight that you place on the operator in that equation, right? Is it 90% operator? Is it 10% operator? And what are your thoughts around that? I have my suspicions, but I want to hear it from you.
No, that's a great question. And I say, this brings up an important point. My personal opinion is that the operator is more important than the property, but I think it's just a little bit more important. So if I really had to weigh it out and I had to give you a ratio, I would say it's 60% operator, 40% property. And even though I think it's so important to make a red bet on the right person, it's also so important to think that you're investing in the right property in the right location, right, for the next 10 years under the right demographics and everything else. So
yeah, that's a very refreshing answer. I've seen seems like a lot of people are polarized on that. You know, it's got to be the asset, or it's all about the horse, or it's all about the rider and not the horse. But that sounds like a very sane answer, that it's both and skewed a little bit toward the operator.
Yeah, I mean, I have learned, and you know, it's funny, and I'm gonna use an example that's not really relevant to this conversation, but I invested in a few startups back before 2008, and they've all gone to zero. And the reason is because I love the idea, but sure. I did not know the management team as well, and I just got enamored with the idea. When I turned that around 100% and just focused on the operator or the founders, and I'm like, I got to make a bet on this person. They've been so successful. They're so smart. And I think I like the idea enough that I can get into it. That's kind of how I do my startup investing. And I'm only in a handful of them right now. Right. But I believe it's a similar philosophy on the and for this conversation. And I think the operator is really important. But I also think that there's so many deals out there, you really should cherry pick the specific properties you like the best at the right price in the right location, putting the team aside, of course, because we've already talked about that. But that's why I'm not heavily weighted just on the team, because I really need to get down to nitty-gritty of the property and make sure I agree with the business plan and why it's being purchased and whether I think there can be predictability there or not.
Yep, that's a great point. What is your process like for vetting an operator that you haven't worked with yet?
Yeah, so that's, I'm going to keep it high level because that could go on for, we can have a whole podcast about that. But way to describe what I do is that I come into it saying to myself, I'm trying to make a bet on a conservative person that I believe I can trust, who I think is going to underpromise and overdeliver for investors, who wants to build long-term relationships with investors and using that philosophy with the hope of having an investor like me or anybody reinvest multiple times. I'm trying to avoid an operator who is taking numbers, making them look good, which anybody can do that if they choose to, make a number look great, market them, attract investors, but not really care what really happens ultimately, because they're just going to go on and market to the next investor and they're going to have that marketing machine. And so I'm trying to avoid the people who are overpromising and potentially going to underdeliver. And what I do is I would call it I tried reading between the lines, essentially. So I do a lot of reading between the lines to understand who am I making a bet on, what is their philosophy, what kind of character are they. Always do background checks, which I unfortunately in my networking for many years have concluded most investors don't do, but I think they really should. Usually will not, I don't think I will meet, I mean, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but I don't think I'll invest in anybody if I haven't met them in person, because that's part of a gut check, right? So all these things, reading between the lines, everything comes down to a gut check. And a gut check, I think, is very important to do with an in-person meeting as well. So that's kind of how I try to nail down, and I can get into more details for sure, but that's how, I do it in combination, reading the overview and trying to read between the lines, asking many questions, some of which I want the exact answers to, and some of which are more to gauge how they answer, to read between the lines, in-person meeting, background checks, et cetera. When it comes to the actual business plan and property and opportunity, I call it trust but verify. So I want to trust that when I make a bet on a jockey that they know how to pick that horse, but I'm actually going to verify the horse they picked and just make sure that I somewhat agree with it and make sure that they've done their research properly and they've actually gone through their checklist and, you know, been thorough enough. So I employ a trust but verify on the property itself, which is very thorough, but that's what it is, high level. Whereas it's a gut check with the sponsor originally as well, and just trying to find that right personality.
Yep, that's a great point. What would you say to somebody that that's maybe a high income earner, but they've got a lot of hours tied to that too? They want to start investing passively, and sometimes this stuff can seem overwhelming. Now, to your point earlier, we've got a lot of tools and resources. You've got, you know, the platforms online. If you're accredited, all of that's open to you to go start just downloading, offering memorandums and reading through them. But are there some specific things somebody with maybe capital to invest, but a limited amount of time to do all this research, what could they start doing to get in the game?
I would say that assuming that this person actually wants to make sure they understand exactly what they're investing in and have 100% confidence of what they're investing in, it's going to take a little time and it's going to take a little learning time. And I think that one of the most efficient ways to do that is to go onto the crowdfunding sites and download opportunities. So what I would say is start out with an asset class that you gravitate towards for whatever reason. A lot of people gravitate towards multifamily because they can understand it, they can relate to it, they've lived in it, and they understand what it is. It's pretty easy to understand.
Right.
Go onto a few of those crowdfunding sites, download 10 or 20 deals, start looking, and you're not really, if you're brand new, you're not even going to know that you want to invest in class B necessarily, right? Or in a B area. So just download a whole slew of deals, development deals, ground up, stabilized deals, everything in between, and start to learn and read and find where you want to hone in. And then when you've honed in on exactly what type of deal you want to do, similar to, let's say, the box that I've created for myself, go back, download a bunch of those types of deals specifically, and then start to compare the similarities and the differences. So you start to understand what preferred return should I have, what split should I have, what management fee is customary, what's the range of management fees that I see here, right? Et cetera. And that's how I learned, basically. I call it like opportunity exposure. And the one thing that you need to take into account, though, is that most of the crowdfunding platforms are intermediaries. That's their business, and they make a spread or a profit and a management fee each year. And so when you download something from a crowdfunding site, the returns are going to be likely lower than if you were to find that deal directly from the operator because of that intermediary that you're investing in. So everything else is probably a fair comparison, but you have to adjust for the returns. So if you got 5 deals directly from operators and 5 deals from crowdfunding sites, on average, the return should be a little lower for identical type deals, and just know that that's the case. If you're super busy and just don't have the time to do, you know, go find deals and network to find deals once you learn, definitely crowdfunding sites can be a good resource for you if you're willing to give up that spread. There's also investor groups out there that can be a very good resource for you too. Those are the two things coming to mind where people can help you to, or resources can help you to find opportunities, short of the networking that is really required. There are some deals now that are allowed to be publicly marketed through something called the 506C regulation. And some of them are fine, but you know, some of them aren't okay. And you need to at least learn enough to know that when you're looking at those, whether or not you agree with the assumptions that have been made, the business plan, it's someone you want to make a bet on, et cetera. So you've got to go through the learning originally, where you're going to have increased risk of what you're investing in. It's just no way around that.
Yeah, that's a great point. You've got to get some baseline or modicum of understanding of the nomenclature and the terms. I tell people the same thing. If you're accredited, you can go look at a lot of investments, nationwide, different asset classes, development, hotel, multifamily, value add, whatever it is. And if nothing else, you're going to start to see a lot of similarities on fees. You're going to start to know what the terms are. And I would tell people, don't go just jump in the first one. But if you're accredited, you can sign up on all these sites and get a good, a great dose of information. You know, the caveat there is don't just jump in. You know, we lost a bid on a deal by millions of dollars a couple of years ago in my market. And then I saw it come out on a crowd platform a month later. And so I thought, oh, well, take a look. And I was just scratching my head on how they were getting to these projections, because we'd literally toured it and underwritten it. And I was like, well, I'm either missing something glaring here, or we're just have two completely different philosophies on this. So, you know,
yeah,
you take it with a grain of salt, but it is a great chance to get exposed to a lot of deals.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a similar story, which is I'm an advisor for Realty Mogul, and I've been an advisor for them since before they launched back in 2012. And I was on the investment committee for a couple of years until they got so big, I just couldn't keep up with it in terms of the time that it was needed for that. But I remember there were deals when I was on the investment committee, we're all sitting around a table looking at a deal. Within like a minute, we're like, obvious, on to the next, like pass, right? Very obvious pass.
Sure.
3 weeks later, we will see it posted up on a different crowdfunding site. And we're just like, how did this get through someone else's due diligence and underwriting, right?
Right.
And so that's the problem with looking at the crowdfunding deals. It's that you have to treat it like you're getting a deal from any other source. And that, right, even though they do their own underwriting, you don't know exactly what they're doing. So that means you have to just start from scratch and protect yourself and make sure that you understand well enough to know how to look through a deal and vet it yourself and know if it's something you think you should invest in.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. But you know, it's double-edged, pros and cons, right? You get access to a lot of deals, push of a button, you get deals emailed to you. That's pretty cool, and that's pretty new too. I mean, that's a pretty new.
Yeah, it's very new, and it just makes the learning so much more efficient than when I started. So,
yep,
it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
It was uphill both ways back when you were starting out, right? Uphill both ways to school.
Yeah, it was interesting. And you know, it's getting easier and easier now, but it's still not 100% easy, because I like to tell people, a lot of the publicly marketed deals are from one of two buckets, right? Either a newer operator who doesn't have the investor base, so they're going out and using the public marketing tool to find people. And there's nothing wrong with that, but just know that they're not necessarily as experienced, right?
Right.
And the other bucket is such a large fund that that you know they're going to have to do some public marketing to get to the end zone. And frankly, in some of those cases, interesting because some of those are very large, very experienced operators, right? But if you're looking for normal size deals, then some of the best deals I find are not allowed to be publicly marketed because these are operators that have been in business 10, 20 years. And of course, I'm generalizing, but they've been in business 10, 20 years and they already have their investor base. And it, you know, you have to network to find those, but they're the most sophisticated operator sometimes because they've been through a cycle or two and they really have learned a ton from many, many deals. So I would be very careful when you're looking at a deal, how much experience, you know, is involved, especially with some of the crowdfunding platforms. You just, there's both sides. There's some great deals like Crowdfunding Club. There's also some new operators on there too.
Yep. That's right. So proceed with caution as always. So what do you see for yourself over the next, you know, 5-10 years of investing? Do you feel like you've got a pretty good system where you can continue to work that? Are you letting off the gas at any point or exploring new asset classes, or what's in the future for you?
Yeah, great question. So what I've done in the last 10 years and honed in on what I think for the next 10 years are going to be the most predictable asset classes, or what I call tier one for myself, that I'll really more focus on. And what I see at the moment is multifamily, mobile home parks, self-storage, and senior living. Now, I'm not saying any of those make sense for me today on average necessarily. And I'm not saying that any of those make sense in a random area with a random operator. But I think that if you look 10 years out as far as predictability, I think there's an argument that those in the right places with the right operators, et cetera, can have a lot of predictability to them. And some of the other asset class I'm more concerned about predictability, like retail, strip centers, office, and some other stuff, hotels. There's various reasons for that. So high level, I'm hopefully going to focus on those four asset classes, plus some single family and some non-real estate stuff. By the way, I still will absolutely look at retail and office center and everything else. I'm going to be extra careful with those from a predictability perspective. Number two is that I've been on the sidelines since early 2017 as a general philosophy, still making investments, but now having to find unique deals, unique pricing. I am waiting for an adjustment or downturn, which I think will eventually come. And when it comes, I will be jumping on, really on some deals at that point. So I'm very excited actually for the next year or two. I think that's around the timeline we're going to see it, but nobody knows for sure. Sure. And so I'm planning on doing quite a lot of investing in the next probably from the beginning period of that for 2-5 years after that. So I'm very excited about what's coming up. I've been waiting a long time for that. As a general philosophy, all I'm doing though is just trying to continue my snowball growing. Compounding is a fantastic thing. I've seen it it's helped me tremendously in a lot of different opportunities I've been in, even some non-real estate related. And that's my general philosophy. It's a it's slow and steady, but compounding philosophy. So I want to just continue down the same path, apply my previous learnings, just keep the cash flow stream building and building. And that's what I really care about when I think about 10, 20 years down the line for myself. It's just the passive cash flow. Passive cash flow, without trying to sound like an infomercial, just completely changed my life, got me out of the corporate world. And so that's my number one focus on predictable passive cash flow. And I don't see it changing anytime soon.
Yeah, that's a great philosophy. Keep refining what's working.
One more thing I want to add. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
I think that one asset class actually I think is going to do extremely well for the next. Actually, the ones I mentioned I think are all going to do very well. But I think that there's one that is poised to undergo a lot of consolidation, and I think it's not getting much attention at the moment, which is senior living. If you look at demographics in the country, there's been a lot of senior living development in anticipation of increased demand in senior living, which has already started. But a lot of that demand really starts to ramp up in the early 2020s and thereafter based on the aging population. I've had a hard time finding operators to invest with because most of the deals I find are all development and I don't invest in those. But right. I'm hoping, if you ask me one change I want to make or one thing I really want to focus on, is to find more and more senior living operators to invest with in anticipation that getting into them now in the next 3-5 years, that in 5 years, 10 years after that, there's going to be a lot more demand than there is at the moment from operators because it's very hard to operate, and also just capital focused on it. I feel like mobile home parks around 2000, 15, 16 started to get really popular. But if you invested in back in 2010, you were really ahead of the curve. I feel like we're ahead of the curve in senior living right now. And I think it's going to go through a similar cap rate compression down the line. That's a random, you know, opinion or guess. But I will be trying to get more exposure to that space if I can find the right deals at the right timing.
Yeah, that's interesting commentary. It's the silver tsunami, right? And you've got the this big demographic, you know, the baby boomers retiring, and that's a huge huge demand.
Yeah, been a very tough nut for me to crack, though, from an investor perspective. It's very hard to find stabilized existing facilities that are actually being sold off.
Right.
Not that many operators in the space because it's very hard to operate properties. It's not like operating a single family or multifamily building. So it's tricky, but that's going to be one of the places I'm hoping to ramp up my networking.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Interesting. Really good feedback. If somebody wants to connect with you, I know you've got a busy calendar, but maybe somebody wants to reach out. What's a good way for them to connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest way to reach me is my email, jroll@rollinvestments.com. So it's jroll, which is JROLL. At Roll Investments, ROLL Investments with an S.com. And don't hesitate to reach out to me. The reason why I'm so busy is because I'm happy to talk to anybody, really, and I'm happy to help any way that I can. If you're new or experienced investor, you want to network. If you're new, you have questions that I might be able to help. I'm not an investment advisor, but for me, my learnings as an investor, if you're an operator with opportunities, I'd love to talk to you. If you're a group that I potentially could join and or network with to look at opportunities with, that would be great. So, but I'm happy to help anybody any way that I can. I've been very fortunate to be in this 18 years and, you know, any way I can help, just let me know.
Excellent. Well, this is a lot of great information here that you conveyed. I think you really added a lot of value here to our listeners. So I really appreciate that. Jeremy Roll, thank you for joining us today. We'll see you soon.
Thanks again for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the DJE Podcast. For more information, please go to djetexas.com.